Good morning, Carborough and Chapel Hill. This is Wilp's Wake Up Call, presented by the Triangle Branch of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. Our website, by the way, is trianglewilp.org. We are underwritten by Internationalist Books and Community Center at 405 West Franklin Street, and you can go to internationalistbooks.org to see what they have for you. And this is Lori Hoyt, and our engineer this morning, as always, is Dick Paddock. We're happy to be here with you, and this morning we're presenting another really interesting show. Our program, Wilp's Wake Up Call, presents some of the most interesting hot news that the mainstream press is unfortunately often not covering. And today we're going to be doing the second part of a tape show, because she was here for such a short time, of Rania Masri, a Lebanese-born local activist. And she was speaking to us people, local people, at the community church, the Chapel Hill Community Church, and was presented by Balance and Accuracy in Journalism. That talk was on Wednesday, August 19th, just a short time ago. And since it was so long, we've put it in two segments. Last week we had the first segment, and next week we're having the second segment. So I hope, because she's coming to us, she's been living in Lebanon, in the Mideast. She knows so much about it from being there, not just reports of it that she is just presenting. She's living it on the ground, and gives us, I think, one of the very important, essentially bird's eye view of what's happening on the street. So we're going to get started and listen to Rania Masri, one of our dear sisters, who is devoted her life to peace and justice.
Those of us who are supporting right of return or end of occupation would be working in North Carolina at the same time to support health care reform. They go hand in hand. We'd be working simultaneously to support union strength, because it goes hand in hand. And it was the same thing that they were doing in South Africa. That's what gave them the sustainability, because they were linking their struggles and recognizing that these struggles are all one. They're all one. So that becomes really, really critical. Fourth, support of indigenous organizations. And here again, he goes back and talks about their experience in South Africa, what worked and what didn't work. And what worked was when external movements actually listened to the call from South Africa and worked with them and supported them, which means then for us, we listen to Palestinian organizations, both in the occupied territories, both in Israel and in the diaspora, and see how we can be working together and not be working in isolation. Which for some, none of here in North Carolina, but I used to work a lot with New York organizations, and the idea of working with anyone else was extremely difficult. So it becomes critical. And then, well, actually, one more thing to add about this, the support of Palestinian grassroots organizations. When we talk about boycott, one of the issues that they're suffering from a lot right now in the occupied territories is this issue that nobody's buying Palestinian goods. So even within the area, it's really hard to find Palestinian goods, and it's really hard to purchase them for a number of reasons. So that means when we do boycott, we also should do boycott. So it's not only that I'm not going to buy this product, but then I'm going to go find Palestinian olive oil and make sure it's Palestinian olive oil, okay, and seek those products. It also means, and this is what we found to apply in Lebanon, I'm sure it applies here, most of these companies that we want to boycott, regardless of what they're doing in Israel-Palestine, we want to boycott anyway. I mean, Starbucks is known for its influence in Israel-Palestine, but give me a break. Starbucks is anti-union, they employ prison labor, they're anti-environment. What they do in Ethiopia is reason enough to boycott them. What they do in Indonesia against the tigers is reason enough to boycott them. And what they do to mom-and-pop coffee stores is reason enough to boycott them. You bring that all together, my God, boycotting this organization would actually be good for our community, let alone as being good for the community we seek to have solidarity with. And we find this applies to numerous other companies that we want to highlight, where we're talking about boycott and boycott and bring them together. And then lastly, the key is isolation, which means that the key is not simply economic boycott. What worked in South Africa was not only the economic boycott. Actually, if it were just economic boycott, it would not have worked. And we've read a lot of analyses from medical departments and academics and research organizations in South Africa that said actually the boycott was good for us economically. It made us do our own research. Just like the economic boycott against Cuba has been brilliant for organic agriculture. The best organic agriculture in the world is in Cuba. So in that way, it was great, okay, you know, on one aspect. What worked in South Africa was that this economic boycott was coupled with a cultural, diplomatic, and academic boycott. It was coupled with that, and that is what made it succeed. It wasn't just the economic boycott alone. And this is where we have a bit of discomfort. Why do I want to academically boycott anyone? Why do I want to culturally boycott anyone? Why do I want to boycott just a tennis game? Why don't I want to have an Israeli sports team come and play tennis? It's something great. It'll be an exchange of ideas. In this aspect, I'm sorry to sound like the Godfather, but it's not personal. The aspect of this is to get the community to say, look, I'm really not liked because of my government. I need to work at home to change my government. It basically is that simple. And the idea of cultural boycott is also so important because the Israeli government has stated time and time again that the cultural importance of Israel is what gives Israel its credibility and its legitimacy. It's something that the Israeli government works on, they push for. They've even paid people to go on Twitter. They've paid people to go on Facebook to simply promote the goodness of Israel. This is a governmental action, which means they see that as hand in hand with other kinds of propaganda. So that means that we see it as hand in hand with other kinds of propaganda. So then what does this mean for our actions? Where do we take all this information? Where do we put it? Going back to here, okay, we've got several different kinds of boycott. Of course, the product boycott, which I'll talk about soon, how we identify which companies we want to boycott, what that means. The academic boycott, which I'll also talk about soon, which is gaining a lot of leverage around the world, which basically means that, example, myself as an educator, I was asked recently to go to a workshop organized by the European Union where they wanted to get professors and scientists together to talk about Mediterranean environmental security. Great, it's perfectly up my alley. Since it's a workshop, that means we're going to be collaborating on recommendations. So I asked them very clearly, is there anyone from Israel who will be there? Not is there anyone Israeli, is there anyone from Israel representing an Israeli institution? Because if there is, I can't go, because I can't collaborate with them on this project. That's what we mean by an academic boycott. It means that if there's a grant, I'm not going to apply to the grant with someone from an Israeli institution. Not someone who's Israeli in the US. Somebody working from Tel Aviv University or Hebrew University. No, I can't do a joint grant with you. That's what it means. It doesn't mean I'm not going to publish in a magazine that there is somebody on the board who's Israeli. That's not what it means. That's what we mean by an academic boycott. Cultural boycott, which we'll talk about recently, means if we have any singer, Madonna wants to sing in Israel. No, don't go sing in Israel. That's what it means. We're not going to be encouraging singers to go to Israel and to be doing performances and to be regarding it as if they're going to France or as if they're going to Nigeria. No, it's not the same. That's what we mean by cultural boycott. Sports boycott is, again, teams, we don't want them to be playing together. That's what we're talking about, this level of isolation. And again, it's a non-violent form of protest that has proved to be effective. Divestment, we're talking about institutional investors. Churches, universities, other organizations, do not divest in these corporations. Do not invest in these corporations, invest in others. Sanctions I'm not highlighting because it's not even an option for us to get governments to actually do restrictions unless you happen to live in Venezuela, in Bolivia, or in Mauritania that actually impose sanctions. But if you live in Venezuela, this whole talk would be different. Yeah. So which companies do we boycott? And this is by a lot of research that was conducted by Lebanese Americans in Lebanon. And so one is companies that invest in Israel or the occupied Palestinian territories. Either one. Okay. So we're talking about Pepsi-Cola. which invested recently, they purchased 51% of an Israeli company. So we boycott Pepsi Cola, which for health reasons, we should boycott Pepsi Cola anyway. So it's not a problem, okay? Companies that invest in Israeli firms, that means there's an Israeli firm that they're investing and they're supporting. Again, we highlight them. So companies that invest in Israeli firms, let me give you some example of those. Caterpillar goes further than investing in Israeli firms. Caterpillar actually custom makes bulldozers specific to the Israeli government so that only for the purpose of home demolition. So it's something that nobody can say, really, I want to invest in this organization. And again, as an American, read The Grapes of Wrath. There was reason enough in The Grapes of Wrath to boycott Caterpillar anyway.
With
U.S. tax dollars, yes. Companies that make gifts to Zionist organizations. Okay, now notice here we're saying, okay, but my God, it's charity. Why should we be opposed to companies that give money to charities? The idea is the Jewish National Fund is considered a charity. Okay, the Jewish National Fund is an organization that specifically enforces the idea of property that is Palestinian to be given exclusively to Jews. So we've got a problem with that organization. Coca-Cola's corporate offices in Atlanta donate regularly to the Jewish National Fund. So does Estee Lauder's CEO. Estee Lauder's CEO not only is the president of the Jewish National Fund, not only is he personally the largest investor in Jewish-only homes in occupied territories, he also runs summer camps to promote Zionism among European Jewish children, and he's gone ahead and bought some really good companies. So emotionally, we should be opposed to this fellow, as well as they continue to test on animals on their cosmetics. So there's so many reasons. Estee Lauder has purchased Clinique and Origin and Bobbi Brown and MAC. I think that's it. There might be another one. So a lot of cosmetic companies, okay? McDonald's gives to the United Jewish Federation. Again, we shouldn't be eating at McDonald's. Nestle is one of those companies that I run out of reasons. I mean, what is it going to be? Their support of baby milk formula that caused an increase in infant mortality in Northern Africa? Or is it again going to be their terrible environmental record, their anti-union behavior, their promotion of really unhealthy foods? Or is it going to be that they donate food and money and training specifically to Israeli organizations? Yeah. And recently, they actually set up a cereal company in the occupied territories specifically. So again, there's so many reasons. And I've yet to pick up on a company that I don't like. Philip Morris, on and on. Companies that invest in Israeli firms, again, we've got the same listing. In addition to Starbucks. Starbucks bought an Israeli company that sells coffee. They bought a coffee company called Shalom Coffee. And then, incidentally, a few years ago, they sold it. Now, they say that they sold it because economically it wasn't profitable. So I'm not sure if we can claim credit for that. But I say, you know, why not? I'll claim credit for them selling that. Though, I'm still encouraging people to boycott Starbucks. So regardless what they do in Israel-Palestine, please don't drink coffee at Starbucks, okay? Companies that open research centers, that open research centers in Israel. And the aspect of this is, well, what's the problem with opening a research center? Again, the idea is that it promotes specific technology-based, military-based, and it encourages the economy. Coca-Cola, Estee Lauder, Johnson & Johnson, Nestle, I can give you a much longer list, but these are just some samples. So you can choose, well, which one do we want to highlight? But these are ways that we identify the companies. It's not simply a company that has a store in the occupied Palestinian territory. Burger King, for example, has one. Again, who wants to eat a Burger King? Supporters of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. These are recent, and I'm saying that these are the ones just this year. Just this year, these organizations said, we support boycott, divestment, and sanctions. Canadian Union of Public Employees, Ontario's University Workers Coordinating Committee, that specific committee. I'm not going to say this in French, but a union in Quebec, in the College Federation there, the Scottish Trade Union Congress, which their statement was huge, very powerful, an Australian Dock Workers Union, very recently, and I mean just 2 days ago, the Fire Brigades Union, which is a British firefighter union, also called for the complete boycott of Israel. Academics from England, Scotland, France, Lebanon, and for the first time, the United States, There is a U.S. campaign for academic and cultural boycott of Israel. That's their website. Very recent. So new that the Haaretz said, wait a second. We're used to European academics being opposed to us, but my God, when U.S. academics make this kind of statement, now we have to get worried. So U.S. academics, and this was all in response to Gaza, but it doesn't stop there. Very recently, academics in Israel published a statement in The Guardian saying, boycott us. Academics in Israel, they said, we as Israeli citizens raise our voices to call on EU leaders, they kind of gave up on US leaders, I guess, use sanctions against Israel's brutal policies, join the active protest of Bolivia and Venezuela, both of whom cut off relations with Israel during that time. We appeal to the citizens of Europe, please attend to the Palestinian Human Rights Organization's call, supported by more than 540 Israeli citizens. This is a hugely important statement, saying that a community saying, boycott us, isolate us, please. They actually said, this is the only road left, help us all, please. To me, this was one of the most moving statements that I read. This was issued earlier this year, again, in response to the Gaza massacre. But when we have people themselves, just like people in South Africa, one of the comments I heard when I was reviewing the history of apartheid South Africa was people were saying, no, apartheid, the boycott divestment movement against South Africa really hurt the South African population that we wanted to have solidarity with. And the response was, well, they wanted it. They said, boycott us. Not only that, no, it didn't actually hurt them because they were being hurt by other much more punitive aspects. But here, Israeli citizens themselves are saying this. This isn't a majority, but it's possibly a growing sentiment. Possibly. Now we can look at this and say, how about it's all talk? And it doesn't mean anything until we see really vast economic shifts. What has actually happened really economically? And again, this is all recent. This is all this year. Massachusetts, Hampshire College, said a historic precedent by announcing its divestment from six companies profiting from the Israeli occupation. They were also the first college to divest from apartheid South Africa. So it means a lot from that aspect. In Wales, the Cardiff University acceded to demands by students and decided to divest from companies supporting the occupation. And this has a lot of historic appeal, in South Africa, dock workers refused to offload a ship full of products from Israel. Given that the first victory the BDS movement in apartheid South Africa got was support from dock workers, this just has a lot of historical appeal. That we saw this happening in South Africa, they refused to offload a ship. And again, to me, what really moves me most about this, more than what happened in Wales and Massachusetts, was its workers getting together with workers in other communities saying, we are not going to support your oppression. We're not going to do it. Okay. Now, possibly, if the workers of the world have, if union leaders were more powerful during the BDS movement against apartheid South Africa, possibly we wouldn't have economic apartheid in South Africa, which is what we have now. Possibly we could have destroyed all the aspects of apartheid, not just political. So I would emphasize that these have to be linked and we need to be working with unions when that's possible. But it doesn't stop there. This is huge. This is really, really huge. The French company Veolia withdrew from operating the rail project to connect the city center of Jerusalem with settlements in the West Bank. And this was completely because of the BDS movement. This was a success from Swiss organizations. And observers said, you know, the Swiss did it with such attention to detail and such meticulous sustainability that they managed to get an organization to lose significant amounts of money in Israel rather than lose more significant amounts of money in Europe. Which was how they did it. Either you stop doing this there, or we're going to divest from you. Either you stop doing this there, or we're going to break off contracts with you in Switzerland and in other parts of Europe. And it worked. It was very successful. And again, these are all examples from this year. More. Motorola. Motorola has a specific department in Israel that works on bomb fuses. And these bomb fuses were very important in the latest Gaza carnage. So there became a massive movement, primarily in New York City, combined with international movements, but primarily in New York City, geared to get Motorola to stop doing that kind of production, and recently it worked. They decided we're no longer going to be providing the Israeli government with these products. So we see these real success stories, not small stories, not this aspect that we got a resolution passed, which is no small thing, But this is on-the-ground difference. And it's more. This is a statement published by an economist in March of this year, where he did a review of economic papers in Israel. And, you know, businessmen ultimately care about the bottom line. And they found that in 1 month, four articles in economic magazines in Israel were saying, look, there's been an increasing European boycott of our products. We don't like it. We're finding more people are asking us to state what our position is with regards to Gaza before they do business with us. We don't like it. We don't want our government to be doing this policy because it's harming us economically, which is exactly what we want them to say. And to find four articles in 1 month in magazines in Israel is really powerful. The catch that he was saying was the momentum has to be maintained and strengthened. If the momentum is maintained and strengthened, we are going to see a transition in policy. Because there's already been rumblings within the economic circles in Israel saying we're being impacted by this, we don't like this. So we see there's a real possibility for victory here. It's not simply small. And 2 days ago, and this really meant a lot, this is what we talk about, the cultural boycott. Leonard Cohen, I don't know how many of you know of Leonard Cohen, Canadian singer, really, really cool singer. He decided recently that he wanted to sing in Ramallah and I believe in Tel Aviv. A lot of protests were geared against him, saying, no, we don't want you singing there. He decided to cancel Ramallah particularly because every single Palestinian organization said, no, we're not going to host you if you're also going to sing there. No, we don't want this. His idea was, we're going to take all the funds from the concert and give it to Israeli and Palestinian organizations. Now, the Palestinian organizations that were named in that fund weren't even contacted. And all the Palestinian organizations that could potentially be contacted said, we don't want money if it's also going to go to the Israeli organizations. No, we don't want that operation. His fund was organized by Amnesty International, which was all the more outrageous. So there became a lot of pressure organized by the BDS campaign on Amnesty International to withdraw its support. 2 days ago, Amnesty International said, we're not going to take care of distribution of the funds, because all the funds would be distributed to Israeli organizations. We're not going to do that. We're not going to be involved in this. So this becomes a success in the terms of the cultural boycott. Okay? Now, to get Madonna to change her mind would be more difficult. In London, and this is the fun thing about this. I mean, Emma Goldman said this, that she wanted to dance with the revolution. You know, and the aspect is that if we want things to be sustainable, my God, they have to be fun. Because nobody really wants to do depressing work all the time. It just, our emotions won't allow us. And we find there's some really creative actions that are being done. In London, organizers go into Tesco supermarkets and they pick up, you know, products that are made in Israel. And they trap them in a cart and imprison them. They're not going to release these products until there's a change in Israeli policy. Basically, they put them in a cart and go around and around in the supermarket distributing material, saying why they don't want people to purchase this material and why they're causing this, you know, fun disturbance. There's all these stories of people doing this. I remember an organization in California, Lesbians for Peace and Justice in Israel, Palestine, love these names. They decided to go into Starbucks and declare that by their religion, God has spoken to them that Starbucks is their promised land and they're not leaving. And you used to find really fun ways of doing this. So this is what's been happening in London, but it doesn't stop there, because arguably you can say that the people who are having the most fun are here in the States. And Ahmad Barghouti writes that there's a lot of diversity to the global BDS movement. He's one of the co-founders of the BDS movement in Palestine. He says, you know, there's a French style, and the French style is they go into chic boutiques in the Champs-Élysées and the mega supermarkets, and they encourage customers to boycott Israeli products. The British occupy university buildings, demanding divestment. The Scots mark Israeli bottled water as containing contamination with apartheid. So don't drink Israeli bottled water because it's contaminated. The Welsh actually catch up Israeli products to drive across a very graphical message. So they throw ketchup on Israeli products. The South Africans don't offload an Israeli ship, thus setting this historical precedent. The Turks, when they recently had to play with an Israeli sports team, actually showered them with shoes, thus following the Iraqi presidents. The Swedes, of course, through meticulous efforts, got to succeed in Viola. And, he says, the Americans boycott Ahava in pink bikinis. This is code pink. And the way that they're protesting Ahava which, how many people here have heard of Ahava? Okay, it's a cosmetic company that says we're using Dead Sea products from Israel, but it's happened to be from a settlement in the occupied West Bank. Okay, so it's not Israel, it's actually occupied territory legally. And they distribute this. And so Code Pink says, no, we're not. And they go in there fully dressed and then take off their clothes. They're in these pink bikinis. They put mud all over themselves and they say, it's stolen beauty. Don't buy Ahava. It's a product made in occupied Palestine. And the thing is, there's been a victory already. If we notice this woman right here, Kirsten Davis, you know, the conservative woman on Sex and the City, she was taken as the face of Ahava after she was chosen as one of the ambassadors of Oxfam. So there became a lot of protest going, wait a second, Oxfam says this is occupied territory. So how could Oxfam be claiming that you are an ambassador of Oxfam and you claim to represent an organization that isn't from this occupied territory? Recently, and we highlighted this as saying, Oxfam dumps, you know, Sex and the City, I forgot what her name is on Sex and the City. And so she got dumped again by Oxfam. The idea that Oxfam just last week, very recently, said, no, we're firing her as an ambassador. They said, you know, it's because we don't have any work for her. Of course, no organization, when they do this, say it's because of BDS. But it's because of BDS, and particularly because of Code Pink. Now, Ahava, if you go to Ulta, which is that mega cosmetic store, there's one in Raleigh, I'm sure there's one here, they have Ahava products. So it becomes a really easy thing to do. And I would say, personally, bikinis are optional, and you know, men, speedos, whatever, it's a really fun thing. Stolen Beauty, which is the website, you can just go to Stolen Beauty, the Code Pink website on this topic, they've boiled it down. They've given the literature, they've given the exact guidelines, how could you go about doing this if you want to do an event on Ahava? And again, this is something that has already worked. The catch is, as Ali Abu Nama wrote in 2009, the catch is we are at a critical stage. We are really at a critical stage, and I'm not saying this simply because, you know, it's good to say this in a talk, we're at a critical stage. We really are. We find two things are happening. The Israeli government is going for more and more extreme measures, and they're going for more and more extreme measures quite publicly. So in one way, they're no longer trying to appear egalitarian. And so many things that they're doing just these past 2 years, it's much more horrific and much stronger and less covered. And I don't think it's incidental that this is happening at the same time that their claim that we attack Palestinians or Lebanese, for that matter, for self-defense is really losing ground. It's really hard to say that the attack against Gaza really wasn't self-defense. I mean, hard to venture. Just as it's hard to accept that the attack against Lebanon really wasn't self-defense, militarily, politically, however way. So there's become this shift. More and more people are rejecting that. And more people are questioning, wait a second, this whole legitimacy of a state only for one group of people based on the domination of that group of people on another is something we have problems with. So we have this fork that's happening, and it all depends who pushes more. If there's more push from the international community, the Israeli government will be moved. I have no question. If there's less of a push from the international community, the Israeli government will continue the move another way. So that's the fork that I think is happening. And this is a fork that's being supported by a lot of analysts. And Ali states it very clearly by saying we must do all we can to push it over. To push it over. What limited South African apartheid from being as horrific in their attacks against the indigenous community wasn't that they had a greater sense of conscience. I don't believe politicians, with the exception of, you know, the politicians I love, actually have that sense of conscience. So in that sense, what worked was this global anti-apartheid movement. And just as it worked in South Africa, it very, very well can work here. I've got no doubt. If we follow the lessons and we learn from what happens in the past, this is typically what a lot of people ask for. So I'm just going to stop on this line and say these are some resources. There's so many more resources, including, of course, this is just a good book as a starter, Ben White. Its book, Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide, is really good as a beginner's guide. Start here, progress then to Ilan Pappé, progress to Jonathan Cook's excellent book, Disappearing Palestine. There's so many resources. But the bottom line, and I tell this to my students, the aspect of learning is when we take information and we get it to change our lives.